Marxism that we have been examining do offer some serious guidance to policymaking. The sections that follow offer a first outline of these implications. In consultations with policy experts in each field, they could easily be expanded into broader programs for action. Economic benchmarks and GDP. Organic Marxism suggests radical changes in the way that human societies interact with the environment. It calls for a restructuring of global economies so that they are focused first on the flourishing of the biosphere, as John Cobb writes. Moreover, scholars are recognizing that material growth often doesn't contribute to the happiness of a nation's citizens. Currently, the Kingdom of Bhutan is the only country to measure its economic progress in terms of gross national happiness, a holistic indicator of citizens' well-being. In 2013, as another step toward holism in economic thinking, Singapore indicated a desire to build its social reserves, as well as its financial reserves. Even using happiness as an economic indicator is not radical enough, however, unless one also takes into account the costs of the class of disenfranchised people and the ecosystems upon which humans depend. Organic Marxism suggests an economic theory that measures progress in terms of social goods. Chinese policymakers, who have focused primarily on gross domestic product, GDP, for many years, are beginning to express concerns about the many crucial indicators of success that are not considered, and in some cases adversely affected, by the standard measures of GDP. Unfortunately, the United States does not offer a good model of calculating the impact of policies on all of its citizens. Lacking holistic measures of whether the society as a whole is thriving, current measures tend to reflect only gains among the wealthiest of citizens. One area that requires particularly urgent attention is agriculture. Just as Mao focused on rural farmers as the backbone of his movement for reform in China, organic Marxism encourages the combination of ancient wisdom and new agricultural techniques in order to achieve social and environmental justice. Some techniques, for example, such as family farms, organic farming, and local food production, have been the norm for millennia. The overuse of pesticides and the transportation of food across long distances have only become dominant practices in the past century. Also, only since the Industrial Revolution have capitalists thought to apply industrial patterns to farming, with disastrous results for soil preservation, crop rotation, symbiosis between plants, and, above all, for the cultural traditions around the planet that depend on small farming communities. The problems created by these practices will be lessened as we begin turning back to more traditional patterns as models for the agricultural sector. Organizations such as the Agricultural Sustainability Institute, the Land Institute, and the Sustainable Agriculture, Biodiversity, and Livelihoods Program of the International Institute for Environment and Development, IIED, have brought major achievements in the science of sustainable agriculture. One of the pioneers in this field is Wes Jackson. Books such as New Roots for Agriculture, Rooted in the Land, Essays on Community and Place, and Nature as Measure lay the foundations for sustainable agricultural practices, explaining traditional methods of medium-scale farming such as crop rotation and biological methods of pest control. They resonate with the deep wisdom that was common sense for human beings until the industrial age. For example, Jackson shows readers how to consult the genius of the place, learning from the land and the ecosystems and working with them in a harmonious manner rather than by domination. Other authors have followed the equally specific suggestions of Dean Freudenberger, offering concrete policy suggestions that include the rotation of crops, no-till farming, and the use of plants that fix nitrogen in the soil. Some agriculture-related challenges will require new research. For example, The Yunnan Academy of Agricultural Sciences has been working on developing a variety of perennial rice that would allow farmers to harvest from a single plot for multiple years. Currently, annual varieties of rice allow rain to erode soil and wash away nutrients. While perennial rice is not yet available for wide-scale agricultural use, it represents a promising development that needs to be supported and encouraged with appropriate policies. Technical advances alone are not enough, however, as long as agribusiness continues to disempower farmers, separating them from the results of their labor. Traditional farming villages and practices offer concrete options for postmodern sustainable agriculture. Manufacturing. Organic Marxism might also suggest new methods of manufacturing. The ancient way that human societies produced things was for an artisan to create each individual thing by hand. With the onset of industrialization, artisans were replaced by assembly line workers, which, as Marx realized, meant that the workers did not own the means of production and were alienated from their labor. It is impossible, of course, to return to a pre-industrial society. Yet there are things that a postmodern society could learn by considering features of an artisan's relation to his work, including techniques for reinstilling skill and pride, identification with one's work, regional distinctives, and even individual uniqueness in producing products. Increasingly, it will become necessary for more and more manufacturing to be done locally in order to reduce the reliance on fossil fuels to transport goods. This shift will mean that a more limited range of products will be available. This is already true in many countries in the world, and it is not clear that having fewer purchasing options reduces the quality of life for the average citizen. As John Cobb writes, "Most of us Americans have far more goods than we need. Our problem is to store them and clear out our closets to make room for new ones. This flood of goods replaced a situation in which most of the things people really needed were produced by hand. Today, handiwork is more of a hobby than a primary occupation, but a shift back in this direction would be a welcome one. If handiwork were prized and its products could be profitably sold, unemployment would cease to be a major problem. We would use fewer resources and own fewer goods, but what we would have would bring us greater satisfaction, and its production would be a creative rather than a routine act." Management. From the perspective of the present, one can see more clearly that what Marx was calling for was limiting the dominance of capital, in part by redistributing power, and in part by building social structures around deeper sets of values. Naturally, it's simpler to run a business if one chooses not to consider the quality of life of the workers, and the profits for the owners are higher as well. Similarly, management is simpler when one assumes that natural resources are unlimited, so that one does not have to consider environmental impact among the real costs of one's operations. The standard approach to the production of capital has been to limit the economics, the calculation of profits and losses, to short-term effects, filtering out the long-term, downstream costs of operation. By contrast, sustainable management is more challenging since it calls for taking a systemic or holistic perspective and managing toward long-term societal and environmental benefits. Market socialism. Reforms within the capital-based model. The literature is replete with social reforms that advocates believe can be made within the capitalist economic model. Some argue either for full ownership of firms by workers, or for shared ownership between the workers and their clients, suppliers, and representatives of local communities and of the planning committee. Both options retain the framework of capital competition, merely modifying patterns of ownership. Other scholars suggest that corporations be reconceived in a more democratic and participatory way. In the participatory economics model of Albert and Hanel, for example, power is shared, and pricing is accomplished, through a kind of equilibrium between workers' councils and consumers' councils. A model put forth by John Romer in A Future for Socialism retains something like shares in corporations, but does not allow the shares to be converted into cash. They can only be traded for other shares. Those and similar models offer compromises between market and socialist economies. We worry about the extent of the compromises that are being called for. It's crucial to track the actual power relations. The ideology of a firm or culture can pretend that all employees are counted, when in fact a very small number of people, e.g. top management and board, actually make the decisions. One of the marks of real shared power is when value assessments are labor-based. For example, Cockshott and Cottrell argued 2 decades ago that it's possible to calculate the labor value of products and then to adjust prices to labor value over the long term. With more recent advances in computing, software, and big data, their thesis has become even more plausible today. Banking, credit, not capital. Abolishing the current banking system is the first step toward achieving a genuinely socialist economy. Current capitalist nations have made themselves deeply dependent on the largest banks, private institutions whose sole goal is profit-making. Because they have the power to create capital through lending and to freely move their profits across national boundaries, these banks carry out functions once reserved for governments only. Because they have the power to create capital through lending and to freely move their profits across national boundaries, these banks carry out functions once reserved for governments only. In a series of articles, John Romer has proposed a credit-based economic system. Because in this proposal, the shares in corporations could not be converted to cash, they couldn't be used to raise capital. Instead, publicly owned banks would provide credit to businesses. These would be, in his words, public banks that could not transform themselves into merchant banks, that is to say, acquire an interest in the capital of non-financial or financial institutions. As Romer writes in A Future for Socialism, the bank's profits, including its shares of firms' profits in the group, would return in large part to the government, to be spent on public goods, health services, education, and so on. This would constitute one part of a citizen's consumption of social profits. In effect, Romer's proposal treats banks like utilities. Many capitalist nations have different rules for major utilities because they provide indispensable services to society, such as water, natural gas, and electricity. This proposal recognizes that providing credit to enterprises should also be done in the public interest. Some theorists prefer the idea that banking reforms could be rolled out slowly, building upon their current capitalist foundations. For example, Thomas Weisskopf has suggested that privately owned banks could be part of an enterprise-based form of market socialism. Marc Fleurbet also supports a hybrid form of free enterprise, one based on credits rather than on capital. Banks, he proposes, could continue to be privately owned, but would be far more constrained in the kind of business they could carry out. In some ways, Fleurbet's proposal sounds like the old savings and loan model in the United States. Families deposit cash with banks, which in turn make loans to households and extend credit to enterprises. Similarly, Tony Andreani would allow banks to be privately managed and to compete with one another. He believes that it is sufficient if they are placed under a national financing fund, which allocates sums of credit to banks depending on the quality of their management, management whose yardstick is always the maximization of labor incomes. This form therefore rests on a public bedrock. All loan capital is ultimately centralized and allocated by the fund. Moreover, the model comprises supervision of the labor market. Like the preceding models, Andreani believes that a credit-driven economy can be centrally, though indirectly, planned, so as to avoid the excesses of the current system in the West, where massive for-profit banks control the fates of entire societies. Centrally managed economies, he argues, are less efficient and cannot be responsive enough. By contrast, planning is, as he puts it, the privileged site of democratic decisions, the site where the major social choices about working time, the balance between consumption and investment, income bands, priority programs, and so on, are made and implemented. Central planning without centralized management also allows for local economies and local businesses to emerge, which bring the same sorts of advantages that local agriculture, family farms, and village societies bring. We are, however, less sanguine about achieving the level of reform that is needed in places like the United States without first challenging the dominant control of a small number of extremely wealthy individuals and corporations that serve their interests. The evidence of the last 20 years, especially the global financial meltdown of 2008, in which bank-caused abuses played the central role, bring evidence against the optimistic view that the extremely wealthy will voluntarily limit their gains and act in the interest of the non-wealthy classes. Any real reforms will have to move away from control by capital and by the few who possess most of it. Such reforms are impossible without a radical redesign of the banking system. In particular, we are skeptical that self-managed banks will freely choose to maximize labor income. More attractive is the suggestion by David Schweikert that banks function as second-degree cooperatives directed by representatives of their workforces, of the funds, and of the client enterprises. On Schweikert's model, like Romer's, banks would be public institutions financed out of taxes whose members are civil servants, interested only in the benefits. Only if they are created in this way can one expect them to genuinely promote social goods, such as the creation of jobs and sustainable investment. Banks driven by the profit motive simply aren't motivated to serve the public good. Chapter 14. What does ecological civilization look like? Why believe in the possibility of political change? Organizing ourselves into social systems is a basic feature of human existence. Among the most significant of these systems are political systems, the formal structures by which humans govern themselves. Decisions about political systems are never made in a vacuum. They reflect the beliefs and values of a group of people, city, state, or nation. They are influenced by what people see as realistic options at a given time, and they are largely determined by which people and which ideas have power. Power comes in many forms, including wealth, armies, ownership of land, and control of major public and private institutions. In history, it's very rare that people with power choose to share it with those who don't have it. Even though many different types of political systems exist in today's world, in most of them, the people who hold power exercise it largely for their own benefit. Some of these are communist states, some elect socialist parties to power from time to time, and many are purely and unabashedly based on capitalist assumptions, such as the United States. What they share in common is that their actual policies tend to favor the interests of those who hold the most power. So, if the powerful rarely give up power, why should one believe that reforms are possible? Karl Marx is famous for advocating higher and more noble goals than capital-based political systems ever have. In the state that he dreamed of, individuals would not exercise power for their own interests. Each one would contribute to the best of his ability, and the resources would be shared across the society in ways that would best serve the common good. It is time, here at the conclusion of our book, to be frank. In light of the historical facts that we have just summarized, we do not think it likely that capitalists will freely agree to support a socialist system. The masses of people on the planet already recognize that the super-rich are being selfish, and that a more equitable distribution of wealth would be more just. But what can possibly compel them to release their power and wealth in the interest of promoting the greater good? We believe that the coming environmental catastrophe will provide the needed catalyst. Experience shows that it's usually unwise to bet against well-established scientific models when they are supported by scientific consensus. Over the last decades and centuries, it's often been religious believers who have bet against science, and generally they have lost this bet. The scientific models agree that human-induced climate change will stretch and eventually break the social and economic structures on which humans currently depend. If the well-established scientific models are accurate, and they generally are, then change is coming, whether we are ready for it or not. Humanity may react in three very different ways. One possibility is that this crisis, the first truly global crisis that our species has ever faced, will bring out the worst in our species. If so, the powerful will use their power to protect themselves, no matter how many people are hurt as a result. Rich nations will use their technology and their wealth to feed and protect their wealthy citizens, fighting off the starving millions on their borders with armies and bombs. Decisions will be short-sighted and selfish. Animals, nature, and the poor will suffer the most. Many people will die, and many species will become extinct. Unfortunately, if human history is any indication, this scenario is the more likely one. There are, however, two other possible scenarios. As civilizational collapse gets closer and closer, and as those in power begin to see that no miracle will erase it, it's also possible that the global crisis will bring out the more noble side of those in power, so that they use their wealth and their influence for the sake of the planet and its inhabitants. Even if their motivations are not purely selfless, it may be that capitalists and corporations will feel pressure to respond constructively to the crisis, as benevolent rulers sometimes do. Finally, it's possible that the masses will see that the rich are protecting themselves and abandoning the rest, and that they will rise up against this treatment. Recognizing that they are becoming the victims of the catastrophe, they may have new motivation to act together in their common interest. Because of our numbers, we could indeed change the system if we were united in action. As the eye of the storm bears down upon us, the 99% may indeed become the source of revolutionary change. It is never too late. In 1972, John Cobb published a book with the title, Is It Too Late? Given the evidence of environmental destruction that was already emerging in the 1960s, Cobb asked prophetically, is it too late for humans to turn things around and begin to build an ecological civilization? Although the book was published over 40 years ago, it is clear that humanity has not yet made this turn. Noam Chomsky, one of the most famous and most outspoken critics of U.S. foreign policy, spoke recently to sold-out audiences across Asia. One of his talks was entitled, Capitalist Democracy and the Prospects for Survival. At one stop, Professor Chomsky was asked how he would answer the question posed in the title of his lecture. What are the prospects for the planet if capitalism continues to dominate human interactions? Chomsky's answer was unmistakable. The quick answer is dim. If it was almost too late 4 decades ago, then mustn't it be too late now? The answer is no. It's never too late. Of course, it is too late to stop the climate from changing, the glaciers from melting and the oceans from rising, many species from going extinct, and many people from dying as a result of what's coming. But it is not too late to lay the foundations for a new kind of civilization. With each passing year, more and more people become aware that humans in the modern period have built an unsustainable mode of living on this planet, and that it is beginning to collapse all around us. To realize this fact is to recognize the need for us to start building a new kind of society, to lay the foundations for a different kind of civilization. What does ecological civilization look like? The ancient Chinese religion, known as Taoism, is famous for its focus on harmony. Nature consists of competing interests, forces pulling in different directions. The wise person is the one who recognizes that contrasting ideas don't need to exclude one another. Recognizing in them complementary dimensions of the one way, Taoists look for approaches that allow different perspectives to work together productively. The wisdom of the Tao contrasts with the common sense of modernity, which consistently turns complementary ideas into philosophies, religions, nations, that are at war with each other. Private property represents an excellent example. For John Locke and Adam Smith, property was the foundation of human interaction, and protecting it was the cornerstone of the state. But for their French Enlightenment opponent, Rousseau, private property was the social equivalent of the Christian concept of original sin, the moment when all manner of evil entered into and disrupted humankind's natural harmony. He writes, "The first man who, having enclosed a piece of ground, bethought himself of saying, 'This is mine,' and found people simple enough to believe him, was the real founder of civil society. From how many crimes, wars, and murders, from how many horrors and misfortunes might not anyone have saved mankind by pulling up the stakes or filling up the ditch and crying to his fellows, 'Beware of listening to this impostor. You are undone if you once forget that the fruits of the earth belong to us all, and the earth itself to nobody.'" Over the ensuing centuries, the followers of both camps became more critical of each other and, as a result, more extreme. Socialism came to be identified with the denial of all private property, and libertarianism came to be identified with the denial of social services, even to those most in need. As we look for the Tao in this debate, the middle way, we do not need to demand a complete communitarianism in which no one is allowed to own anything. The human drive toward ownership and competition is not inherently evil. It's the excesses that need to be restrained. Consider another example. Many in the West recognize the damage that consumerism and radical individualism have caused, the injustice, the environmental destruction. They support radical reforms, including changes to the system itself, but they have been taught that the only alternative is a violent and abusive form of communism, the kind that the world saw during the darkest years of Stalin's rule, or in some of the excesses of China's Red Guard. Why would the formal debates proceed as if these were the only two alternatives? By demanding a forced choice between extreme alternatives, leaders in the East and the West have backed us into a corner. We cannot lay the foundations for a new type of social and global organization unless we challenge the assumptions on which the faulty structures have been built. First among the assumptions that must go is the belief that modernity has forced the world to choose between mutually exclusive options, capitalism or old-style socialism, individualism or communalism, unlimited wealth for the powerful or the abolition of private property, humans or nature. Throughout this book, we have challenged that assumption. If there is hope in the postmodern turn, as constructive postmodernists believe, it lies in the renewed openings for hybrid solutions. For example, like most philosophy students in the West, in our classes we debated individualism versus communalism and wrote papers defending the one position against the other. Why did the professors treat these as exclusive options? Isn't meaningful community, in fact, an answer to the emptiness that individual isolation creates in cities around the world? Must it not be our goal to explore new possibilities for living creatively in community with each other? Modern capitalist societies have brought about the collapse of the village community, the clan of relatives, and the extended family. Today, fewer and fewer children grow up in intact nuclear families. Our technologized lifestyle and the pace of life that it produces have further whittled down opportunities for meaningful face-to-face interaction. People also feel the loss of deep encounters with nature and with other species. Organic Marxism is not only an economic and political philosophy, then, it is also a response to this yearning for community with each other and with nature. Of course, issues of wealth, power, and injustice don't just go away. They have to be dealt with. Still, the idea that people and the environment might come together again is not a romantic dream. It's a basic yearning that stems from the nature of our species. We seek participation in vibrant, organic communities because humans are social animals. We seek fulfilling work experiences because we actualize ourselves through what we do. We seek creative and artistic expression because it is in our nature to dream of a better world than what we see around us. Organic Marxism, a third way. In this exploration, we have sought to examine the resources of Karl Marx's philosophy with fresh, postmodern eyes. Like Tom Rockmore in his famous Marx After Marxism, we have not accepted that the history of Marxism offers the last word on Marx. Rockmore insists that most contemporary philosophies pale in comparison with Marxist theory of modern society. In this respect, Marx is very obviously a true giant, the author of the most impressive overall theory of the modern world we currently possess, a theory which, despite its many flaws, really has no obvious competition. Marx, for the first time, provides a credible theoretical framework to comprehend modern life as a whole. In this, he has no real competition, no theory of similar size and breadth with which his own could be compared. Also, like Rockmore, we have treated Marxism not as a closed system, but rather as an open system. Read in this more open-ended way, many details of Marx's analysis speak more strongly today than in the past. What it means to distribute wealth and power justly, why the 1% becomes richer while the 99% become poorer, how the tragic gap between use value and exchange value can be narrowed, why capitalism is connected with ecological devastation, etc. In particular, we've seen the ecological reformulation of Marxist principles opens doors to contemporary insights that one does not find in other systems. Marxist analyses of social ecology, such as the now classic arguments in Murray Bookchin's Remaking Society, Pathways to a Green Future, demonstrate why class domination patterns must be corrected simultaneously with the domination of nature. We speak of a third way because this fusion of socialist and ecological principles is not identical to classic Marxism. The policies of organic Marxism do not center on huge state-run industries, nor do they seek to eliminate all private property, family and small business production, and market exchange. Remember that one of the most organic socioeconomic systems in the history of humanity was the small farming community, which combined family-centered production and local markets with high levels of cooperation and collaboration for the sake of the community as a whole. Three features in particular characterize this middle way. Organic Marxism advocates the emergence or re-emergence of hybrid systems with the acquisition of wealth constrained by societal needs. It supports the ownership of private property within limits set by the carrying capacity of the planet, which means that both values and constraints are based on the communal and planetary common good. It endorses educational systems at the university level as well as in primary and secondary schools that function to instill knowledge and values that reflect the needs of ecology and the demands of justice. Since these three principles sum up our central conclusions, each one deserves a word of elaboration in these closing pages. 1. The emergence of hybrid systems. In earlier chapters, we endorsed a hybrid system in which markets are constructed so as to support thriving on all levels: local collaborations, regional associations, and the global community. Neither of the pure economic forms, pure capitalism and pure socialism, has consistently benefited all three levels. One must acknowledge that, historically, the inefficiencies of fully socialized economies have not produced adequate gains for their citizens. Certainly, the level of corruption in completely socialized economies, such as the former East Germany or North Korea, is not in the people's interest. Such economies, we suggest, will increasingly be replaced by hybrid systems that combine profit-making activities with regulations that are designed to prevent corruption, environmental abuse, and the inordinate acquisition of wealth by a small number of citizens. Managing hybrid socioeconomic models requires an open systems approach. Hybridity is a distinguishing feature of multiple interlocking and interdependent systems: human and non-human, economic and cultural, and of course, market-driven and regulatory. Whereas Marxism in the Industrial Age was synonymous with massive state-run economies that were centrally managed, organic Marxism is adapted to the Information Age. Here, the focus shifts to smaller-scale communities, microeconomic systems, and capacity-centered planning. In deterministic systems, managers seek to control outcomes through targeted interventions. In so-called chaotic systems, by contrast, managers, including the state, are co-participants in evolving systems that no one can completely control or predict. 2. Beyond the private-public dichotomy. Debates in political theory have tended to prioritize either the private or the public sector as their primary focus. Some seek to broaden the realm of what is considered private and to protect it from public scrutiny: liberals, libertarians. Others tend to project family values outward onto the nation as a whole: the religious right. As organic Marxists, we recognize that neither of these tendencies provides the solution. On a planet in peril, one needs to ask how the values of the whole can guide individual and family decision-making, and one needs to explore how the support structures of family and local community can help build local and regional self-reliance. Both of these responses have been typical of traditional rural and small-town economies through human history. Back to Marx, scholars have researched and presented the values of commitments that are expressed across Marx's work, for example, in his portrayal of the capitalists, the bourgeoisie, and the proletariat. Because of the standards for scientificness, Wissenschaftlichkeit, that dominated in his day, Marx believed that he had to ground all values in objective historical and socioeconomic studies. This modernist conviction led him to downplay the important role of transformative values within specific cultures, emphasizing instead the universal laws of the class struggle. Never underestimate the power of ancient stories and classic texts to challenge the status quo and to motivate change. Put differently, organic Marxism means embedding Marx's dream of an egalitarian society within the organic context of a given people and culture. Contrast this approach with the libertarian tendencies in American society. Libertarians limit the public interest to protecting the life, liberty, and property of citizens, moving concerns about quality of life and deeper values to the private sphere. The trouble is, such values are the glue that hold a society together, lifting attention above self-interest to the interests of the community as a whole. As Michael Walzer has recognized, nations cannot survive on such a thin platform of values. Many of the sustaining values are birthed in home and hearth, They are captured by the religious or folk beliefs of the people, and they are nurtured by the arts and literature. Drawing absolute lines between private and public prevents the core values of a people from flowing into its public institutions and from nourishing and guiding its public square debates. Overly sharp line drawing also blocks public or national values from working their transformative power on individuals, families, and communities. The United States, since the 1980s, and other developing nations more recently, have begun to see a generation of young professionals, some of the most gifted and well-educated citizens of the country, pursuing careers based only on the gains for themselves. This was the class of people responsible for the global financial crisis of 2008. Under a libertarian ideology, of course, this is expected. Career decisions are private decisions, relevant only to the individual and his friends and family. But in an age of global climate disruption and of unsustainable economic practices, questions of career and lifestyle are no longer purely private. It's not only governments that need to take a systemic or organic view of the global situation. Individual citizens, especially at higher educational and professional levels, must do likewise. When one concedes this point, the heated battles over ownership and private property look rather different. A society gains from a healthy private sphere and from responsible levels of private ownership. Yet acquiring and caring for possessions works for the common good only in the context of shared civic values. Individuals can only thrive when the whole system thrives. 3. Beyond value-free education. No area more clearly represents the fusion of private and public interests than the field of education. It is no coincidence that, in countries dominated by capitalist and libertarian strategies, universities sought to become value-free. Individuals wanted to get the best education for themselves. Disciplines were responsible for their own standards of excellence, but not for any external values. And businesses profited from the university-based production of knowledge and technology, which they could later market to their advantage. Of course, universities were never really value-free. The best British universities trained and socialized the servants of the British Empire, who looked back on their time at Oxford or Cambridge as their formative period for national leadership. Liberal arts programs at American universities taught the canon of classic texts, which imparted not only a sense of what constitutes excellence in writing, but also clear statements regarding the values by which one should live. American universities were more Confucian than they admitted. The growing crisis in American higher education has come as those canons of knowledge and values that every educated citizen must have come under attack. Government officials are now looking for cheaper ways to train workers in the skills of the marketplace, for example, through online professional degrees. For many, values training has now become too expensive and has been eliminated. Organic Marxism calls for an educational system, universities as well as primary and secondary education, that functions to instill knowledge and values that are consistent both with the continued existence of life on Earth and with just ways of distributing resources and opportunities. At every level, from child to adult, the process of education cannot help but instill values, whether explicit or implicit. While pretending to be value-free, many Western universities, in fact, fostered the values of competition, nationalism, and the free market. Today, most acknowledge, the planet needs global citizens, not individuals driven solely by the interests of their particular community or nation, or by the desire for personal profit. Arguably, university reform in this direction is one of the most urgent changes necessary in the West, since the impact of the university experience sets the values of people's lives and work, not only in the early years of their careers, but throughout most of their adult life. Studies continue to show that individuals with a strong liberal arts education individuals trained in clear thinking, strong writing, and values-based reflection are most likely to rise to the highest positions over the course of their careers. If the roots of ecological civilization do not grow during the university years, it is very unlikely that they will be able to do so later. Clearly, the need is not for superficial indoctrination, which often has the opposite effect from what it intends. Far more useful are educational reforms based on fostering deep reflection on values and on how they can influence subsequent actions. Far-reaching reforms are needed if education is to provide a rich foundation of shared values for the global citizens of the future. In each of these three important areas, organic Marxism clearly stands as a third way. It is not a romantic retreat into a primitive past, or an anti-technological stance that robs humanity of tools we will need. But neither does it endorse unrestrained consumerism and personal gain as the only motivation. Upon reflection, what's surprising is that we would have reduced the rich range of complementary options to just two competing opposites in the first place. The real alternative to consumerism, for example, is to discover a deeper set of social values, organic values, that link one again to the land, to nature, and to those cultural traditions that support them. Similarly, the real alternative to radical individualism is the rediscovery of vibrant, transformative community. Final conclusions. We live in an era when stronger and stronger forms of individualism are coming to dominate, even in highly communal cultures such as China and India. This unremitting focus on the individual is a byproduct of the new global dominance of Western capitalism and consumerism. As the Workers' Vanguard wrote recently, "By reducing the human relation to nature purely to possessive individual terms, capitalism thus represents, in spite of all its technological progress, not so much a fuller development of human needs and powers in relation to the powers of nature, as the alienation of nature from society in order to develop a one-sided, egoistic relation to the world." Organic Marxism represents an important force of resistance against radical individualism and consumerism. It places a strong emphasis on the importance of communities, within which individual identity and resistance to the status quo is fostered, grown, and developed. Community exists at very many different levels: family, school, work, sports association, village, town, province, and nation. The nature of community at each of these specific levels is different, but the shared principles of organic community hold in every case. The goal of this movement is to wed the positive features of thriving organic communities with a consistent Marxist emphasis on the common good. Ours is a strange time. To science and to citizens around the world, it is painfully clear what must be done to avoid global climate catastrophe. Yet citizens are frustrated to find the obvious steps being blocked by big business, which is unwilling to let its profits go, and by the inaction of governments, which place their national interests above the needs of the planet. Why, when faced with the urgent need for change, do humans continue to create in-groups and out-groups, claiming that good values are to be found only within one's own group and vilifying all others? In national and global debates, leaders set up false oppositions and then insist that the true answers are found only in their particular camp. In this chapter, we've seen how the path to wise and just policies is blocked by ideological battles. Observers of Washington witness perhaps the most painful examples of inaction due to the inability to compromise, but it is not difficult to add examples from other parts of the world as well. With the help of contemporary Marxist analyses, we recognize that the reasons for the stalemate are systemic. It's not that leaders are opposed to sustainable earth-centered policies. It's that the system of modern capitalism is incapable of making the switch. The nations with the largest GDPs don't want to change the rules of the global economy because the current rules bring their citizens so much wealth and comfort. Developing nations have to play by the economic rules established in Europe and North America, since there's no other way to raise the standard of living for their citizens. Thanks to the IMF, the World Bank, and other international organizations established by the wealthiest nations, the poor nations find themselves falling more and more under the control of the dominant powers. Once we understand the fixed rules of the global system and whom they serve, we recognize that there is no quick fix. The goals of the environmental movement can no longer be limited to symbolic steps, supplying band-aids to a dying planet. Nothing less than civilizational change will suffice. Movement leaders around the planet are beginning to lay the foundations for a new ecological civilization because they realize the need for fundamental change in how people think and how we organize human society, both locally and globally. In these pages, we have traced the history and the concepts on which the new ecological civilization is being built. The social, political, and economic principles of modernity are, sadly, still often unrecognized. Marx provided some of the most effective tools for uncovering them, which is why we have argued that Marxist analyses are indispensable. But transformative socialist principles need to be embedded in cultures and embodied in post-capitalist communities. For that reason, we have used organic as the umbrella term to express the central features of the civilization that is even now being born on this planet. Sustainable, culturally and historically embedded, constructively postmodern, process-based, fundamentally local, communal in its orientation, in a word, ecological. The momentum toward civilizational change is now building across the planet. People-based movements for revolutionary change are visible in virtually every country. The movements are being driven by daily news of the growing environmental catastrophe, driven by the very air that we breathe. What should be life-giving has become toxic, driven by our inborn sense of justice and common sense. The citizens of this planet will not watch it be destroyed before our eyes, robbing our children and grandchildren of a healthy habitat just because the wealthy and powerful are unwilling to change. We believe that this growing momentum for change will not stop until many features of late modern European civilization have been replaced. The conditions for such radical transformation were not yet in place at the time that Marx wrote. Sadly, it has taken the first truly global crisis since human civilization arose, a humanly caused crisis, to create the necessary global momentum. Only as this organic movement becomes global will Marx's dream of transnational reforms finally be realized. It is the dawn of a new form of human civilization. Individuals, societies, and nations are now deciding whether to keep fighting to preserve the dying order or whether to take leadership in building the new. It's not a matter of waiting for more data. We already know what the old practices are doing to our planet, and we know what it takes to build a global society that is socially, economically, and environmentally sustainable. The ones who will make the greatest difference are those who work and live with wisdom, with diplomacy, and with restraint, placing the good of the whole planet first.
Thank you.
This has been Organic Marxism, written by Philip Clayton and Justin Heinziker. Narrated by Seth Clayton. Music by Seth Clayton. Copyright 2014. Production copyright 2015 by Process Century Press.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.